Floodgate Broadcasting.
Evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heathen Half with me, Heathen Vegan, on Renegade Broadcasting.
Guy.
Hold up. We've got some random callers calling in straight away. I'll get your calls later, guys. I haven't even introduced you yet, so just give me a minute. Sorry about that. Hopefully I'm coming through all right tonight. I've move my setup a little bit so I don't have the problems I did last time, but the fan on my computer is still going quite badly because we had a bit of rain after last week's show, and but the heat is still really pounding us at the moment. Last few days again we're being melted here in the British Isles, but onto this show. Well, I mean, I've been busy this week, very, very busy. Lots doing because I think I mentioned before that we might be moving soon. Whether it's soon or whether it's long, that's in the hands of the gods, I suppose, and the goddesses. Especially the goddesses, as they are the sovereign deities. So they determine where we should go and when we should go, I assume. Along with ourselves, of course. But no, it's been a hectic week. Again, just reminded, well, the last few weeks, actually, reminded just how crazy our world is, just how many loopholes, the red tape involved in absolutely everything these days. Jump through hoops and then more hoops, and then there's no guarantee. Oh, there's always fees attached to every hoop you want to jump as well. They don't like giving you any breaks here. I mean, like I say, my recent experience with trying to move house has just exposed just how the amount of bureaucracy that are, I mean, nonsense as well, all nonsense, all based on lack of trust, lack of community. It's everybody wants to cover their backs, and the middlemen again get everything. They get all the insurances and, you know, no guarantees, but you've got to go through this check and you've got to go through that check. Or, you know, you can't even apply for a property. And then there's a new thing that we didn't, you know, we have marvelous references, not missing payments from free landlords, but that's not good enough. We still need guarantors, et cetera, because, you know, we're not the type of people that should be upward movable. We come from the rougher, poorer areas. And we don't have the incomes of some of these people, so they want guarantees, they want this, they want that. Just showing you again, they don't want you, the working classes, the white working classes, out of their hole. We were reminded of this when we first started some of the businesses that we started. There was absolutely zero help from our government. I mean, if you're an immigrant and you've just turned up, then you're just fine and dandy. You can get all the help. You can get all the help you want. Loans, grants, the grants. Like I said, because we've looked into charity work, there's nothing for our people. If you want to go into charity work, the only way that you can make money, because charities are money makers for most people. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their own hearts. They have executives, they have board members, and they all get paid. But so this is why we see the rise of all these charities, because people can make money out of it. They can make money out of pandering to immigrants, and people don't care. A lot of people, they don't see the problems that we see, and they just go along with it. They go along to get along, as it were. But yeah, for us, when we open up at nothing, we have to scrimp, save, and beg to get our businesses off the ground. I remember actually even at what we call the job center here, when you need to, if you want to get any help, you have to go. It's kind of a government building here in the UK that deals with people that are unemployed, people that are starting a business, deals with the whole range. I mean, I think it's still called the job center. It could have changed. I don't have much dealing with them. We had a woman that was seeing us, almost scoffed at us when we were starting our own business because of the area we come from. She thought herself much better than her. She thought herself much better than us, sorry. And that she hasn't got her own business, so why the hell should we? That was her attitude. I mean, it really was. It was quite blatantly obvious. She was snobby, and, well, you know how it goes. But that's the kind of help the white working classes get. Just a reminder in my daily life just how much the system is set against us, especially the poor working class. If they've got nothing to get off you, then they keep you down. And we're actually going to get into that in the main part of the show, but I just want to talk about a few things before then. We're going to get into a few things about our society and where it comes from, what originated it, and this is going to harken to the Bronze Age pervert, but I don't really want to go on about him too much, but it's that whole idea. We see it coming out of people like Varg Vilkunas, or, you know, the whole alt-right had it, this fucking, I call it this masculine domination fear. We're going to go through that, and we're going to get into a lot of stuff. But before then, I just want to talk a little. I haven't had a chance to catch any of the recent news this week. I've really been snowed under because, like I say, whether we move this month or 6 months, we don't know, because you jump through hoops, you have ups and downs, and you've got to go with it. Do you get the property you need? Do you not get the property you need, or do you have to wait? Either way, we have to be ready to move at almost a moment's notice. So that means that we've got a lot of work to do in the house, clearing out, making sure we're not taking, you know, the regular stuff that comes with moving a house. And obviously then save, get deposits, blah, blah, and all the fees and everything. It's just a, like I said, a nightmare of red tape and just ass backwards, everything is. But, I mean, also we're dealing, you know, we've had some perseverance with certain things, with the authorities over certain things that pertain to this. I'm not going to go into detail because, not that it's bad on my part, I just don't want to give people a deep insight into what's going on sometimes, but trust that we have to face the authorities for our beliefs. And we do that, and that just reminds us again the patheticness of this system. How just, I mean, the schools, the colleges, any academia, any government, they accept communists. You can be a communist and be a lecturer. You can, I've said this before, you can be a member of parliament and stand in front of a hammer and sickle, that's fine. But if you have any type of view that falls into anything remote, and I'm talking remotely here to do with National Socialism, any, even in joke form or whatever, you are hounded and hammered as a threat to the system. And I suppose we are, but not in the way they think. Not in the way most people think, because most people think of National Socialism in the terms that are given to them by their oppressors. And that is that, you know, evil 6 million, the evil people that caused the tragedy of the 6 million, which is horse shit. Although I don't know how long I'm allowed to say that. in this country because the laws are getting so insane. But I guess we'll see, because I'm not going to stop saying it, because I'm not going to start lying to obey the law. I mean, if you're living in a system that forces you to lie to stay within the law, and you're doing no criminal act, you're causing no harm or hindrance to anybody. In fact, you want to do the absolute opposite to that. I don't see why we should shut up about such things. So, but I mean, I covered the laws. I read them out. Well, not laws. What were they called now? That was their guidelines. They're not laws yet. They're just guidelines. I've seen a few people posting about it recently, but it's been around a little bit. But as always, Renegade's pretty up on the take here, so we're ahead of the ball game in a lot of areas. As usual, hopefully the guys coming behind will... well, at least we can teach them something anyway. That I don't know how many people... Everyone thinks... I still see a lot of this pandering to the alt-right. Even though the alt-right is almost dead now, there's still this residue that it's almost left on some good people too. They can't quite get past it. But I do see more people talking about the working classes, more people talking, not that I want a class divide. I'm a national socialist. I believe in the class unification. But it's good to see people understanding that at this moment in time, the white working classes have it worse than anybody. I mean, and the middle classes are being undermined. They don't realize it yet. They think it's all good. They're the people that are setting up these charities. They're the people doing all this stuff, thinking they're getting a good deal while they're essentially tying the knot in their own noose. Hopefully we can get more of those on board, though, and start to see that this is not a class problem. This is a indigenous population problem. We're being wiped out. We're being genocided, and there's no need to tame that. Those words are, we are being genocided as much as people mock us sometimes for saying it and laugh and scoff at us, which is all they seem to do, really. A couple of comments now, one of my articles, it's just scoffing evil Nazi crap, which, you know, we're kind of used to. But the poor have no place. The poor whites have no place. They are not worthy. I remember a story my father told me when there was big unemployment, I think in the early 80s here, massive unemployment. Nearly the youth could not get work. The younger, you know, up until coming into the job market in that age was just, there was no jobs. And my father went to the job center, that I talked about earlier, and said, and they were going to stop his money because he hadn't jumped through a certain hoop or whatever hoops they wanted him to jump through, which are all pointless. I've done it in the past where I've had to, at points in between work, especially when I was working for myself, I'd have no work and I'd have to sign on to get to pay my bills. And they make you jump through every hoop possible. And if you forget or mislay or do one thing wrong, which are all stupid and pointless, most of the things they're asking you to do, that's it. Money stops. But they were going to do this to my father in the 80s. And he's like, well, there's no jobs. There's literally no jobs. And I said, well, your money's going to stop. And he says, well, he just talked to the person. I'm not sure if it was a woman or a man, but he talked to the person behind the desk and just said, look, do you think I'm going to go out there and starve? And he made a veiled threat, I suppose. He said it could be your car, it could be somebody else's. It could be, you know, I'm not going to lie down and die in the street. I'm going to fight for my survival. So you can stop my money, but that's not going to help anybody. And like I said, this was not him begging. He never signed. After that, after his experience in the youth, he never signed on ever because he didn't want to jump through their hoops. Even when he had no work, even when he was desperate, he wouldn't blur himself to these people. Because that's their attitude. It doesn't matter if you've got nothing and you're a good-intending person. They don't give a shit. They'd see you on the street and starving because you're not worthy. You're poor and you're white. You're not needed. And it's all your fault anyway, probably. There's no jobs. That's your fault. The economy, that's your fault. You know, we get on about this. I mean, I've put the plastic straws up a few times already, but we're all concerned about plastic straws and there's people starving. I mean, America, these poor areas, where there's absolute poverty for white working classes. No work, no jobs, no hope, no future. Yeah, I sadly see even these alt-right types, these pompous twats, going, you know, look at these idiots, you know, and mocking them, essentially. I mean, I don't know what, mocking their own folk that are poor and been let down by the system. I mean, that's, and yeah, there might be fault here and there. There might be some fault. Somebody might have, they might have made an error. Not everyone's perfect. And in this hellhole, you got to realize a lot of the poorer people, they're not as educated. Forms that become more and more convoluted, more just to, well, I remember there was some forms here, tax forms, they changed the wording to make it more confusing on one of the questions and save themselves millions, the government. The forms are deliberately confusing, so you don't know which box to tick, so you tick the box that you think is going to get, well, the good intended people, the good, honest folk tick the box. It's gonna, they don't want to cause any trouble. So they're like, well, I'll just be on the safe side. I'll say I'll do. Always costing them money, but, you know, that's what this, that's what they're there for. This is what these forms are there for. But again, it's always the good intended and, you know, they're not so educated. They can't work through all the pompous language that's in the forms. They don't know what's going on. So the poor, honest white folks, they get screwed. Oh, if you're an immigrant, you'll get an advisor. You'll get everything you need laid out because you probably can't speak the language. So you get a freaking lawyer to go for your things, or paid for by some charity or another. So they make sure that they don't lose out on anything. But, you know, I'm not willing to go down. I'm not willing for this to happen to my folk, me or them. I want better for them. I want better for my children. And not just on a personal level, I want better for our children. Because, like it or not, we're together. No matter what you do, this is what they don't understand. These people that pander to this idea of immigration and we're all the same, they don't realize that when it comes down to it, when their back's up against the wall, they're going to see you as them as a white guy or a white woman or a white whatever. And they're going to see you as the oppressor. It doesn't matter what you do. You can bend over backwards. But in this age, I think it's important that we teach our children to be brave. We need to show them that there is more to this life than just good times and self-satisfaction. That there is, at certain points in history, a generation or several generations are called on to sacrifice for the future of their folk. And I truly believe that we're in one of those eras. That it is our, we are the generations that, if we are going to save ourselves, if we are going to have a future, then we're going to have to make sacrifices. And this is going to be in many ways. Sacrifices, like I said before, like Kyle. Carl could have had a good job. Carl, obviously, I'm talking about Carl Hunt. He could have had a good job. He could have cruised it easy. YOLO, had a nice house, nice car. He chose to make some sacrifices. I make sacrifices in my own way. Not enough, always. I always need to do more and I always feel pressured to do more. And the more I learn about my ancestors, the more I feel pressured. And that's something we're going to get into tonight. Because there's so much poison against ourselves, so much of tainting of our past, and even on our so-called allies, like I said, with the this masculine domination, this worship of Rome. Well, I'm going to try, I mean, I've covered this a little bit in other shows, but I want to bring a few things together here, you know, about... Well, it's going to cover a lot of subjects. It's going to delve into a bit of my spiritual beliefs, what they actually are, because I never really explained them and how they entwine with this and why it's important to me. It's going to talk about, you know, the circle and the square, or the squaring of the circle. But not too much, but there is some interesting into the things I've come across over the years that just show a different mindset. Because a lot of my work, when I'm trying to research and trying to do things to understand my answers, it's all about understanding them. I've said this before, but sometimes you don't always see what you want to see. But I always want to be honest to them, truthful to their intent, what they were. I don't want to paint a picture of them that isn't true. And I want to, but some people go, well, you know, you put forward all their higher aspirations. But of course, I'm going to put forward even in cases where they may not have reached that level. But what they dreamed of for themselves and, more importantly, for us. What they dreamed that they could be. And that's one of the great things about mythology. You know, we have to submit to something better than ourselves. We talked a little bit about the filter, the guiding spirit, your communication with the divine, right, that follows you through your life. Well, it's interesting that in Old Norse, it's kind of a pun for folk. You know, we must submit ourselves to our greater selves, the filker, and our filker, our folk. It's interesting that they sound the same, although spelt slightly differently. I find that quite poetic, actually, and there might be a lot in that, especially in some of the poems that our ancient bards wrote. But yeah, like I say, to the main topic tonight, it's mainly going to go into the mindset, because obviously that Bronze Age pervert, which he would have been considered a pervert in the Bronze Age, by the way, I make no doubt about that. His book is called Bronze Age Mindset. I haven't been able to read it, and I'm not buying it. But from the bits that I've gathered, it's more of the same. It's nothing revolutionary. It's more of the same that we started seeing coming out of the alt-right from their inception, really. Especially the Christard part of it. This women are nothing but subjects to the man. And this is why I call it masculine domination. Now, I'm not anti-masculine, by the way. There are very many great masculine qualities and properties. But to say that the Bronze Age, of all places, was the birth of this idea is quite ridiculous, actually. Quite funny that he calls himself a Bronze Age pervert when he obviously knows very little about the Bronze Age, other than a little bit about the Aryan invasion theory, or this Eastern migration of people that people believe occurred in the Bronze Age. Now, I do not dispute that entirely. I don't think it's as simple as that, though. Obviously, I've done some shows with SC and Kyle on a northern migration. And I think without understanding the northern migration, you won't understand the backwards migration that's coming from the east. But just to delve into that a little bit before we go on, and how it fits into what I want to talk about tonight. This idea that the Aryan peoples were a heroic culture, noble culture. And this is attached to freedom and not being a slave. So then there's a lot of hypotheses put forward that these Aryans were an elitist system. And by that, I don't mean in a necessarily good way. I mean in an elitist system that they would conquer and dominate a group. Now, there is some evidence of this in the East. And that's because they say these Aryans came from the East. The Aryans, remember, in this Aryan migration theory, they did not come from Europe. This is one of my biggest problems with it. It basically wipes our history before the Bronze Age, so we can lay no claim to it. I think it's playing into our enemies' hands, actually, by following this. So because this domination theory that appears to be in white people that or this idea of domination in the East, which I don't fully buy either, but there's some evidence suggests it was slightly different, and we're going to get into that in some later examples. That then they've said that this was a masculine dominated society. that had the idea of elitism over a general population. So it seems like people like Bronze Age Pervert has took that little bit of information and decided it is absolute fact. I doubt he's looked into it himself. And then he's based his whole perversion of the world upon it. And then, I mean, in that little video that was highlighted on Red about Red Ice on the Renegade Tribune, we see, I'll get the name of that for you so that to make sure that people can see it. It's called Red Ice Promotes Bronze Age Perverts Homoerotic Fantasy of Masculinity, which is a good title for sure. But no, so that from that little video there, you get this idea that that's the basis of it. It's Aryan migration, Aryan elitist domination, masculine domination. Now, I don't dispute that they were warlike. I don't dispute a lot of things, but we need to understand this a little bit. But it's funny that in that, most of the examples he gives are Iron Age or Roman Age, which is quite a while after the Bronze Age. But like I say, we're going to go through that. So let's start off with the Aryan migration. And so I've just explained a little bit about it. So what happened when they came here? Well, not much changed. And that's the biggest problem with this migration theory, especially in Northern Europe. Very little changed. There was an article, I believe, on the Tribune about water worship, something that I have got more and more into, more and more understanding of. And its importance in our ancestors' worldview was massive. And this does not change. We see it in the Neolithic. We see it in the Bronze Age. We see it in the Iron Age. So if there was a migration, they took on the culture of the people. If they were Aryan dominating people, dominating some swarthy people, as Varg would put it. And don't worry, I have got a show planned on Varg, by the way, which should be interesting, where I'm going to take apart some of his nonsense. So that's one to look forward to. But rather, so they would have took on these proud elitists, took on the culture completely. Anyway, we'll get into it.
Government, media, and academia. Repeat.
Jews are poor. The government and media are anti-Semitic.
Hola! You've just heard Chosen, one of the oldest languages known to ape. Try another. Mayenta is fat, ugly, and Sephardi.
My wife is beautiful, intelligent, and spiritual.
Good job! We have Chosen learning pods in synagogues, lodges, even selected pizza restaurants. Learn Chosen and stay ahead.
Vaccines are safe. The Holocaust was real.
So fluent, so chosen. Fees, obligations, and genital mutilation apply.
Thank you.
Welcome back, guys and girls. That song there, by the way, I'm sure people are going to ask me about that because it's a real good tune, that one. So I'm just going to say now, that is the Cavalry March of the O'Neills. It's a real good song. I like listening to that. I mean, there's no vocals in it, but it's definitely got a... fires me up, and I have got some descendancy from that part of the world where the O'Neills once ruled. And just a note to the caller that's hanging on, I will get to you in the second hour if you're happy to hang on. But anyway, I was talking a little bit about how the culture did not change with this aerial invasion. We also see in that video, they put the Venus figurines. It's like, oh, this was all in the backwards age of Europe. Till these Eastern migrators come in, these Eastern Aryan migrations come in and dominated the landscape up here. And the Bob, again, we have the idea that the East, coming in from the East, was culture. And us up in the North, we're just barbarians worshipping some female deities. Like, well, it doesn't change. The females being as the highest deities, it's not popular theory even today, but because of the Viking Age, and I'm going to get to that in a bit, but it was clearly still there in the Iron Age. Just a couple of quotes here from Tacitus on the Germanic peoples themselves. But they are distinguished by a common worship of Nerfus, that is Mother Earth, and believes that she intervenes in human affairs and rides through their peoples. There is a sacred grove on an island in the ocean. And it goes on to say that that grove is where they worship her, and the chariot gets taken. Also about another northern Germanic tribe. These are both northern Germanic tribes, tribal groups, more than one, several tribes. They worship the mother of gods and wear as a religious symbol the device of a wild boar. This serves as armor and as a universal defense, rendering the votary of the goddess safe even amidst enemies. That's the late Iron Age. That's the Roman Age in most of the world, but the late Iron Age in northern Germany. And they're clearly still having as their main deity a female. However much the alt-right dislike this and people like Varg don't want to talk about this kind of thing, it is true. Well, I don't always believe what Tacitus has to say, but there are many other references to this. The wild boar, I've done much research on it. And in nearly every instance, it is connected to a female deity, whether that be in Britain or Greece, or even Egypt itself. Nut was in some early depictions, and she's the mother of gods, by the way. All the ones you know of Horus and all of those, their mother is Nut. And she's in very early depictions depicted as a boar, a sow, with her little piglets, well, boarlets. I forgot, and for some reason I forgot the name, so I do apologize there, what a baby boar is called. But, so... there we can see, and there was no place other than Northern Europe where the boar was more revered than in Northern Europe. I mean, no place in Europe where the boar was banner and helmet. From Beowulf, we have all the mentions of boar helms. From archaeological finds, we have boar helms. Standards and boar in names. In the mythology, the boar is always there. The boar is a symbol of struggle. But this is the duality of symbology that many people fail to see. And the more I've delved into symbology, the more I've begun to see this duality. But rather than you can be the... So it even in the language, but I'm not going to get into that tonight because that's a whole other subject. And probably one I will do because it is very interesting to see how words form, how dual words form out of the same idea. And this can be easily proven in the language, actually. But back to the female. So we have clear evidence there alone, but we're going to get more into detail. Where does this Where does this idea of this masculine domination come from? Well, it too comes from the East, that is for sure. We see it starting to permeate ancient Greece first. This is not the Bronze Age still, though. This is the very early Iron Age in that part of the world. Because the Bronze Age occurs differently in different parts of the world. Where Bronze Age or iron is starting to be smelted and used, it changes the age. Sorry. So we see this idea coming first into Europe through Greece. We see it with Athena, with this domination of man. We see this is where the bureaucracy I was talking about earlier, this is where this was all invented. Forms and paperwork. You needed to feel certain. This is the squaring of the mind. We went from circular homes to square homes. This is particularly true in the north. Up until the Roman period, we were building in circles up here. Always. And even through the Roman period, many people, the not so wealthy, built in circles. The not so refined. Those that had not pandered to Rome. And also, even after the Roman age, we see the circles coming back, although the Anglo-Saxons do have a slightly squaring of their circle, which is part of this, as the alien influence on our mind has started to take hold. And it becomes worse and worse as the centuries go on. But it starts in ancient Greece. Now, they hadn't quite perfected it, so their society fell apart, mostly from over-questioning. They weren't as strict in their rules as they could because they still had the European mind, so they couldn't quite fathom it. I mean, a good way to see this merging of worlds is the Spartans. Spartans were this idea of an elite Aryan group that did hold slaves, so they had an idea of domination. Yet, their females were very powerful in those times. In my recent article about cowardice, I talk about on your shields or with it. That was what the Spartan wives were said to have said to their husbands as they went off to battle, meaning victory or death. Come back a winner or dead. And as I said on the show with SC, the Athenians used to marvel at the physical prowess of the Spartan women. So they had emerged. They hadn't quite been totally overtaken. They hadn't denigrated the female, which is what happens as we get more into it. It happens in Greece, actually, in Athens. They start to denigrate the female. They start to say no woman can be your equal to a man except for actually a whore. Which might go to show just where the society is going. And we might start to see some similarities with how we're seeing the perverse promoted in our modern age as being the most enlightened among us. But that age doesn't really affect Northern Europe at all. The Northern Europeans still keep stomping through there in their natural way of war. They don't want people to serve them. They want land to live, which is not a birthright necessarily. It is an earned thing. You have to earn that land through your own blood and your own willingness to sacrifice. So they would march through, and we have many, many accounts of many Greek writings of certain Gauls coming down and eastwards in search of land. This was a common practice, happened throughout Europe. This is another thing that goes against this Eastern migration theory. All the early literature talks of Northern peoples moving outward, and it's probably, I agree with the National Socialists' work on all of this, the Spartans and the Greeks, I believe actually most of the Greek mythology, which all sets itself in the Mycenaean period, probably comes from the north. But that's probably for another show too. There's a lot of interesting things in that. And I need to do a little bit more research on that because I've seen lots of connections that are really interesting, actually, pointing to a northern origin of specific myths, and not just talking like Carl did the other day about the solar myths, but all myths. They seem to share so many similarities, and it's the place names in the north almost match identical to those place names in the ancient Greek mythology. But it really comes, this oppressor, this idea, and I'd just like to add a few words about the people pushing it first, like Bronze Age Pervert and all these people. They're fantasists. I mean, they're fantasizing about this because they're weak. And what they actually want to do, just to explain, they do not want to free their folk. They want to be the oppressor of them. This is why we get all the denigration of our folk. This is why they look at the poor, I was saying earlier, and say, look at those pieces of shit. They don't, you know, denigration of their own because they do not meet their standard. They believe themselves superior. They do not fight for their folk because of a love for their folk. They fight for their folk because it shouldn't be the Jews dominating them. It should be them. It's just a pissing, but they're just idiots for the most part, like Bronze Age Pervert, as that article points out. Homoerotic, but we'll get into that. Where does this start again? We have a lot of evidence from Greece that this starts to infect. This is not that all of early Greece was infected by this mindset, but it was starting to show its face in the European world, in the European mind, and it was coming from the East. This there can be no doubt because we can watch as it moves through Europe, because obviously the next place it really infects, and then later affects the whole of Europe is through Rome. Rome probably again started as a northern territory, a northern peoples. The reason I say this, some people would argue, but they were surrounded by Gauls. To the south of them, there were Gauls. To the north of them, there were Gauls. To the east of them, there were Gauls. And to the west of them, there were Gauls. They had changed because they had took on a lot. They'd been heavily influenced by the Greeks. And they'd taken it a step further. This infection of the mind, of the European mind of domination. So instead of, like, the Gauls around them had fought a war, like I said earlier, had beat people. They were not cowards by any measure. They fought for everything they had and were willing to risk their lives for it. As I've talked about the Cimbri many times. But they did not subject the people to slavery. They kicked them off the land so that their children could eat. Now, some people bring up points that this maybe is not a very nice thing to do, but this is the way of nature. This is a natural way. If one wolf pack gets too big, it needs more territory to feed its pack. It has to take territory from another. This is not survival of the fittest, although it does act in that way because, as I get into, there's an order amongst this. We're not animals. We don't act on these primitive urges. We can act on these primitive urges, but we can rise above and we can have honor in our actions. And we will go through that a little bit. But this, the reason I get offended by this, I mean, and the reason it really plays into me here before I go into Rome exactly, is because I'll just talk a little bit about my spiritual belief here. I got to everywhere I got through following a trail. Everybody does it when they go on their own spiritual journey, when they go on their own seeking of the gods and the ancestors and the goddesses. And you'll learn and you'll read and you'll go down different paths and you'll start to notice and observe. And you go off into little areas. And one of the areas I went off was into the Mother Goddess. I was fascinated by reading about things from Tacitus, reading about all the many examples, especially when I got into the wild boar symbology. I started to see this and I felt a real connection. And from a child, I had certain things that happened that were very strange to me, that I made no sense of till I was older. And so my devotion at the most, and I'm not scared of that word either. I don't fear saying that I am devoted. I don't fear saying that I serve them. I serve the Mother Goddess. In Nordic terms, it would be Freya. But the Mother Goddess is always connected to water and has many names throughout history. The Tuatha De Danann, Dana, literally comes from a river goddess. There are many names, and there may be many of them, because they are sovereign, and they attach themselves to the land. This is something that people don't really understand about deity worship of our ancestors. Even in Roman times, they practiced this. You didn't necessarily just take your gods with you. You would find in the land that you dwelled, what gods dwelled there too. This talks a little bit about what I was talking about, boundaries. And how in every different place, there was different spirits and different deities at work. And so it wasn't so much as imposing a deity upon the land. It was seeking what deities were within that land. And then paying homage to them for allowing you to be there. For giving you good harvest. For protecting you with secure position. This is why the riverways are littered in the north with swords and things of, massive value. I said before, this is a massive value they're throwing in there. Things worth as much as your house, thrown into the river to give praise to that that gives them life. So, and that's just a little side issue that I'm going off on, but this idea, and this was always related to the sovereign, the mother. But you might go, well, I talk about Woden. I'm a follower of Woden too, but in my own, not on my own personal gnosis of how I got to Woden, my journey to Woden came through the mother. Without the mother, I wouldn't have got there, and I wouldn't. So I'm happy to call myself a Wodenist too, because I believe that he is the protector of the mother. He is the divine leader of the folk. he is the divine, and that is the archetype that is seen in many, as I've talked about with Hitler. As earlier I didn't mention, but when I was doing the notes, because I've only had very short time to prepare these notes tonight, I ended up getting sidetracked by watching Adolf Hitler speeches. Which every now and again I forget to watch them for a while, and I watch them back. And and the power in them is something immense. So my spiritual beliefs are rooted in the Mother Goddess, and I'm happy to say that I don't fear that. I'm proud of it. I believe it is the origin of my ancestral worship. It goes back before this masculine domination period, and lived on throughout it. This is one of the reasons that I believe that the Greek mythology as well, they talk about water nymphs. Well, the place where there's water nymphs and water deities is the north. They're everywhere. No peoples. I doubt anywhere other than Britain has so many votive offerings to the mother, to the water goddesses in the world. I mean, I'd have to check that fact, but I'd be pretty willing to bet that that's the case. But where does this come from? Well, in a lot of where does this idea of masculine domination in the heathen world come from? You can see it in the Christian world. I mean, I don't need to go through that. Obviously, the original sin idea comes through women. This idea, it's part of this Eastern domination. But where does it come from in the pagan world? Well, it comes from the last incarnation of our great faiths in the north, and that is the Viking era. Well, firstly, I'd like to define the Viking era, because I have a lot of problems with anybody that studied the ancient history of the north will have problems with the Viking era. Because Tacitus himself talks about people with round shields, sailors, raiders, fight by sea with boats that have dragon heads. I mean, is that a Viking? I mean, it sounds like one. And that's Tacitus. This is 700 years before a Viking, before the Viking era. We also have in that point what is called the Saxon Shore that the Romans constantly fight against. They're sea raiders raiding the Roman Empire, and massively. Some of the biggest forts, the Roman forts in Britain, are on the east coast to protect against the Saxon Shore. Heavily armoured, thousands of men protecting the trade lines to the east. Romans putting in mass investment into these trade routes and these communities that were serving them. Communities of slaves, but we'll get to that. So now, would I call them modern? No, because these Vikings, they're attacking an enemy. That's a very different perspective to what we get later. The Viking era starts with the attack on Lindisfarne, according to historians, which, like I say, 700 years after what I've just mentioned. Now, the first attacks were clearly religious in orientation. They were attacking churches, temples of the Christian gods. And like I said with SC, I believe we talked about this anyway. I could have talked about it after, but this was a response, in my opinion, to the conquest of the Saxons by Charlemagne and the Christians. And I think I talked about this with Kyle. But what comes later as this Viking era goes on is not very noble, in my opinion. Some would disagree. But these were people attacking and raiding for personal gain, not for glory of their folk. Simply for glory of their name. Now, this is something that we're going to see starts with Rome. If you read much of the literature from the Viking period, or just after when they're talking about this type of literature, these pirates are still a curse at that point, and they call them pirates in the translations of the old literature. It's simply pirate. They don't call them Vikings because they're causing them havoc too. In the Viking era, which is what we call Viking, and we think of a ship going around raiding somewhere, there were farmers, there were peasants, there were working the land, there were noblemen that were serving lords and champion and fighting these pirates for their lord and to keep the land safe. So this simplistic idea of the Viking era as just going out raiding, robbing and raping, is again a bastardization of what really was occurring at that time. Sadly, because it was the last incarnation and that is how it's presented to us, many modern day pagans believe that this is the way that we've always believed. And like I'm going to show, like this is coming through the Romans and it is infecting our minds and it still infects us today. A lot of what I talked about earlier is going to tie into what I'm going to speak about later in this. So it's not really the Bronze Age mindset anyway, what they're talking about here. It's the Iron Age mindset. And not really even the Iron Age for that matter. But it does start there, in Europe at least. So what were our ancestors then? Who were they? We've talked about a little bit about this. But I want to really focus on what they're not. And that is delving into Rome. Because a lot of this idea of the mass, or just an example of what Rome was. It's military. To join the Roman military, you could not be married. And if you joined it and were married, it was an annullification of that marriage. Now, understand this too, that you would serve in the Roman military for 25 years. So a 20-year-old man joining the Roman military is going to be 45 when he leaves. If he leaves. If he lives. So in that time, yes, they might visit brothels or whatever else, or these other things that were going on in Roman areas, Roman-dominated areas. But they have... I'm going to lay, put it down that there might have been a bit of... homosexual adoration going on too. Long camps away, no wife. It may lead to some perverse acts. I don't know. Maybe I haven't looked into that too much, but it all seems to me a little bit gay. I understand it from a masculine bonding perspective, but the no wife part does particularly interest me, because not only that, it's a destruction of the people, because how likely are they to be able to father a child? Remember, we're talking Roman period. 45 was quite old then. This is not like today where, you know, some rich 45-year-old probably could father a few children and look after them. In that age, probably not. So basically, these young men of their conquered lands are being withheld from having wives and having children and forced to fight and die for their masters. I mean, talk about keeping the population down and just keeping it to, which we're going to get into, because we're going to get into a speech by Tacitus in a bit. So this idea of Rome domination, it can be easily seen as the implication to the land. Like I say, the square buildings appear everywhere. This bureaucracy with centers for bureaucracy where all trade must go through, all taxes must be paid. This was something unnatural to our ancestors before them. And actually, when they left, was completely disbanded by the people in Britain, at least. They just ditched it wholesale. All the market towns that had arisen just fell to nothing. Because it was still, even after 500 years of Roman domination of my isles, it still was not our mindset. And as soon as they left, their mentality left with them, but it had left the seed of infection, which is what we see now, partly in the British Empire, or what was the British Empire. And just to understand this with the, before I move on, sorry, because I forgot to mention a point, like with Woden, people go, well, Woden was literally called feminine. Ergi, which is a slur in Viking times. And practiced its Seder, which was a female-only magic. So he's connected to the mother. But sorry, I just forgot to add that, so I just thought I'd add it there. So Roman's domination is not working with nature, as I talked about our ancestors doing earlier. Finding the deity. Anyway, I think we have a break. So I'll catch you in the second hour, guys.
YouTube, show it me again.
After getting censored relentlessly on YouTube, with video after video and channel after channel getting taken down, we have decided to try a different approach.
We now have RenegadeVids.com, which features all the documentaries, parodies, compilations, sketches, and video discussions that are simply too accurate for the kosher censors.
There are now many hours worth of hard-hitting videos waiting for you to watch and share. So get on over to RenegadeVids.com.
Kein böser Zauber kann vor der Eigenmacht bewegen. Renegade Broadcasting. Hard-hitting talk radio.
Welcome back. This is me, Heathen Vegan, on the Heathen Hearth on Renegade Broadcasting. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for staying so far. I do apologize. My notes being a bit sketchy, like I said at the beginning of the show. I had little time to prepare for this, but I'd had it going on in my mind for a while. But when I had to rush the notes down, because obviously I've been very busy this week. But on the just before I continue, the good news about that is when I do move, I am going to get a much better setup for this. So I'll be able to get better audio and a better environment all round for producing radio. So that is the good news with the move once it happens or when it happens. But before the break, I was talking about this domination. This essential rape of the land, not whereas our ancestors seek to work with it. They seek to dominate it, and they impose their structures upon it that collect the taxes. And you've got to remember that this was a complete slavery system in Britain. And slaves had no rights. Same, I mean, it was absolute decimation of people too, the culling of the Brits. Especially in Britain. I talk mostly of Britain because this is where I know most of the... It's where I spend most of my time looking, for obvious reasons. And same happened with the Normans later, which were... it's an anagram of Romans. And they're very similar. I mean, in the north of England, the Normans decimated it. Literally killed off mostly everybody there. I mean, it was terrible. But this is where this mindset gets us. This is where this mindset... takes us. So rather than working with the land, and this is same goes for with the male female, they want this masculine domination. And I'm not talking here about feminine domination. I'm talking about working together, both man and woman, both folk and land. This is the way our ancestors saw it, but we'll get to that in a bit. But this Roman domination of land, I mean, this Roman domination in it. It essentially seeks to benefit of the misery of others. That is the essential system, because it was a slavery system from its outset. In Roman times, though, it was not like today. It was just more brutal and upfront with what it was. Now it tricks us and hides. But it's the same system, I assure you, in its sense. And this came from the East. It is Semitic in origin. And once it infected our minds, that's how they got in. Because they were masters at it. Their mind didn't need to change to develop with it. Their minds were already there. So they will always be one up on us in this world, because they've been doing it for thousands of years before us. And we are still held. We're held back in that sense because we're not them. We'll never be them. And as much as they infect our minds, as much as they pervert some of our folk, the general folk are never going to be fully in line with it. Because it doesn't match our soul. It doesn't match our way of being. And like I said, war is inevitable. War's not necessarily a bad thing. There are just reasons for war. And I've covered this many times, but, you know, two tribes that need land to feed their children are going to have to fight over that land. And there's no wrong there. Both are right. And then it is down to fate and their ability whose children get fed. I mean, it's that. That's the harshness. That's how it works in the real world, not in this world that we have today, this world that tricks us into thinking we can just feed the whole world and forget about ourselves. When we collapse, what happens to all that aid that goes abroad? Nowhere. Mass death all over the world, which is what these people like. They have to cull us. Like I say, the Romans called us. The Normans called us up here in the north because they want just enough people to work the land. They don't want too much. Now, I'm going to read now an excerpt from Tacitus, Agricola. And he talks about Agricola's conquest of Britain. But Tacitus is obviously a little bit annoyed with Rome at this point. I'm going to read this. It is a speech that he puts into the mouth of Galcacus. Now, who was said to be one of the mighty chiefs of the Caledonians. Now, is this speech exact? No. Did Tacitus hear this speech? I doubt it. But Tacitus, of all Romans, probably had one of the best understandings of both the Germanic and the Bronze and the British peoples. And because of this, it is worthy to mention. And it also does expose what Rome was all about. So I'm just going to take a sip of water before I try and read this excerpt, because it's a few hundred words. But later I will pick through it a little bit just to highlight some of the points in it. So, okay, let's go for it. But I think you'll find this insightful. Whenever I consider the origin of this war and the necessities of our position, I have a sure confidence that this day and this union of yours will be the beginning of freedom to the whole of Britain. To all of us, slavery is a thing unknown. There are no lands beyond us, and even the sea is not safe. Menaced as we are by a Roman fleet, and thus in war and battle, in which the brave find glory, even the coward will find safety. Former contests in which, with varying fortune, the Romans were resisted, still left in us a last hope of succour. Inasmuch as being the most renowned nation of Britain, dwelling in the very heart of the country and out of sight of the shores of the conquered, we could keep even our eyes unpolluted by the contagion of slavery. To us who dwell on the uttermost confines of the earth and of freedom, this remote sanctuary of Britain's glory has up to this time been a defence. Now, however, the furthest limits of Britain are thrown open, and the unknown always passes for the marvellous. But there are no tribes beyond us, nothing indeed but waves and rocks, and the yet more terrible Romans, from whose oppression escape is vainly sought by obedience and submission, robbers of the world, having by their universal plunder exhausted the land, they rifle the deep. If the enemy be rich, they are rapacious. If he be poor, they lust for domination. Neither the East nor the West has been able to satisfy them. Alone among men, they covet with equal eagerness poverty and riches. To robbery, slaughter, plunder, they give the lying name of empire. They make a solitude and call it peace. Nature has willed that every man's children and kindred should be his dearest objects. Yet these are torn from us by conscriptions to be slaves elsewhere. Our wives and our sisters, even though they may escape violation from the enemy, are dishonoured under the names of friendship and hospitality. our goods and fortunes they collect for their tribute, our harvests for their granaries, our very hands and bodies under the lash and in the midst of insult are worn down by the toil of clearing forests and morasses. Creatures born to slavery are sold once for all, and are moreover fed by their masters. But Britain is daily purchasing, is daily feeding her own enslaved people. And as in a household, the last comer among the slaves is always the butt of his companions. So we in a world long used to slavery, as the newest and most contemptible, are marked out for destruction. We have neither fruitful plains, nor mines, nor harbours, for the working of which we may be spared. Valour to the and high spirit in subjects are offensive to rulers. Besides remoteness and seclusion, where they give safety, provoke suspicion. Since then you cannot hope for quarter, take courage, I beseech you. Whether it be safety or renown that you hold most precious, under a woman's leadership, the Brigantines were able to burn a collie and storm a camp. And had not success ended in supineness, might have thrown off the yoke. Let us then afresh and unconquered people, never likely to abuse our freedom, show forthwith at the very first onset what heroes Caledonia has in reserve. Do you suppose that the Romans will be as brave in war as they are licentious in peace? To our strifes and discords they owe their fame, and they turn the errors of an enemy to the renown of their own army, an army which, composed as it is of every variety of nations, is held together by success and will be broken up by disaster. These Gauls and Germans, and I blush to say these numerous Britons, who though they lend their lives to support a stranger's rule, have been its enemies longer than its subjects. You cannot imagine to be bound by fidelity and affection. Fear and terror, there certainly are. Feeble bonds of attachment, remove them. And those who have ceased to fear will begin to hate. All the incentives to victory are on our side. The Romans, who have no wives to kindle their courage, no parents to taunt them with flight. Many have either no country or one far away. Few in number, dismayed by their ignorance, looking around upon a sky, a sea, and forests which are all unfamiliar to them, hemmed in as if were and enmeshed, the gods have delivered them into our hands. Be not frightened by idle display, by the glitter of gold and silver, which can neither protect nor wound. In the very ranks of the enemy we shall find our own forces. Britons will acknowledge their own cause. Gauls will remember past freedoms, and the other Germans will abandon them. As but lately did the Usipi. Behind them there is nothing to dread. The forts are ungarrisoned. The colonies in the hands of aged men. What with disloyal subjects and oppressive rulers, the towns are ill affected and rife with discord. On the one side you have a general and an army, on the other tribute, the mines, and all other penalties of an enslaved people. Whether you endure these forever or instantly avenge them, this field is to decide. Think, therefore, as you advance to battle, at once of your ancestors and your prosperity. They were the words given to a great general of the, chief of the Caledonian tribes by Tacitus. Now, like I say, we can basically say that that's not necessarily exactly what was said, but within that little piece there, we have many, many interesting things to come across. I mean, it talks about, I mean, we'll start from the back because I've just read it, but we talk about, you know, they have no wives, which I mentioned earlier, because he's talking about their enemies have no wives. He's talking about that they wish the destruction of them all. Talks about slavery and what the Roman Empire was really about. And when they say they covet equal eagerness, poverty and riches, what they're saying is they don't care if they conquer the poor or the rich because they can put all to work. They can steal the riches from the rich and they can put the poor to work if there is work. I think that's it's a crucial piece in understanding the Roman Empire for what it is. It is the lust for domination and nothing can satisfy it. And this is essentially what this mindset is about. This masculine domination, as I call it. When it should be a balance of woman, man, land, folk. But I mean, just to emphasize this point, in that same piece, he talks about those that became enslaved by Rome. And especially the richest that came enslaved. Because you've got to remember that there were some tribes in Britain that sided with the Romans completely. And used them to fulfill their own desires of domination. But Tacitus says about this, he says, "Hence too, a liking sprang up for our style of dress and the toga became fashionable. Step by step, they were led to things which disposed to vice. The lounge, the bath, the elegant banquet. All this in their ignorance they called civilization, when it was but part of their slavery." Now, this is important to understand because today we see the same problems. We see this disposition to vice and we call it our freedom when really it is our slavery because we are serving that which seeks to enslave us, whether it be perversion, whether it be any vice, or just the brutal hardship of servitude. And this needs to be understood. This was written by a Roman. That speech was written by a Roman, and he puts it in the mouths of the Caledonians. One, because he understands them. Two, because this is what he showing you the raw underbelly of Rome. What it's really about. It's not about honor. He talks about armies of men with no land, no wives. They fight for nothing but their name. And as he says, you know, it is only held together by their successes. Once they lose, they have no tenacity to carry on. There's nothing left to fight for. And it was proven right. When Rome fell, it fell as a whole. There was nothing left of it. It lived on in the East only. Why did it live on in the East? Because that's where the mentality originated. The Europeans threw off its yoke. But it had been ruled by it for a very long time. Like Britain was ruled for it for nearly 500 years. And this, it planted a seed of infection of domination that we see come occur later. Now, when I talk about bureaucracy, I want to make clear something, though. I'm not talking about laws of men, like laws of honor. What I'm talking about this unnecessary law that is all about, as I said earlier, sapping, as he's talked about in that speech, about what they can drag and pull from them. Can you tax them? Can you work them? It is all about self-gain. It is a baseless society, a rootless society, which reminds us again of the East and our enemies and their rootless nature. The Roman could be at home anywhere because he was infected by the virus from the East. and it had infected him at his core. When we compare this to true Bronze Age cultures, built on family bonds and unions, when we compare it to their feminine worship, I mean, which is talked about by the Romans as well in many, I haven't got all the quotes here, but there's so many where they talk about how women fight alongside us, fight alongside the men, how women, the Kimbri, as I mentioned with SC, how it was their women driving the war, driving the heroism. It was the women that were killing the people as they came, as they ran from the battle, their own, killing their own as they run from the battle, not accepting cowardice. And it was this union that made us powerful. And unlike the Roman that seek to use anything to his advantage, it seems to me, the more I look at it, that our ancestors, I mean, the Roman age, from the Kimbri, you get an idea that these people saw fighting as a duty-bound subject for their folk. And this brings us to the actual motivational forces. There are two main motivational forces in this world for a man to do anything. One is his family and his folk. That is the way of our ancestors, the true way of the European. That is his ultimate motivation. That is which he is willing to give his life. That is willing which he is to sacrifice all things. The other motivation is domination and perversion of the man. That motivation comes from self-narcissistic ideas of self and self-worth that are above all others. This is the Roman way. They come in. Their motivation is domination, self-wealth, which we see today with all these CEOs and all these bankers, all these white men playing their game, wearing the toga, and are going to the bathhouses, being infected by the vices of their enemy and believing that they are civilized. We see it in Roman times too, where chiefs were won over by the wealth of Rome, given paid in gold and fancy villas for their servitude. But to keep their wealth, to keep their fancy villas, to keep the gold flowing from Rome, they needed to provide Rome with slaves, provide Rome with the work of the slaves, which they did. These traitors believed that they were civilized and that we were the barbarian. Totally alien ideas to Europe. And we can trace this right up to the Iron Age, right up before Rome, that these ideas did not exist. Which is 2,000 years ago, these ideas start to infect us. Interestingly, same, as soon as that infects us, the next thing that comes along is Christianity to infect us, to reinstate and reinforce the idea of this masculine domination of the people, to reinforce the rape of the land for their taxes, for their tithes. To upstand the Church of Rome. They use Rome for many of their things, but first it took an infection, and that's why I have become in myself more bold, more courageous with the more that I learn of my ancestors, because the more that I learn of them, I start to see the world differently. I don't see in squares, I start to see in circles. I start to see in all things life and spirit. It's interesting with this moving of house that I talked about earlier, that you wonder, am I working with or out? And then you see all around you all the things that are involved, all the aspects of where you are moving and what you are moving to and what you are leaving behind. Seeing things pulling and throwing, calling and wanting you and not wanting you. And it's an interesting dynamic that the world becomes a very different place Things that work against you can sometimes reveal themselves later to be fortunate for you. But you didn't know it at the time because you couldn't see what was working behind the scenes. Something that I've had to practice with this, and I've practiced for a while, was gratitude. And keeping an enthusiasm for life, an enthusiasm for what's going on about us. And I learned this from looking at what our ancestors did. Never giving up on anything, taking every obstacle, every defeat, and seeing some deeper meaning within it, some deeper force to push you on. It's about matching that enthusiasm, that desire, that dream with your own ethic. So when you fail, you don't look at the world like a child. And, you know, we see this many times with children when they hurt themselves, right? And they blame the object that they bumped into or fell onto or fell over. They blame that. Rather than see that they needed to pay more attention to what was going on. And it seems to me that this is what our ancestors practice. And the more I try to practice it, the more I try to see that in all things, it's encouraging me onward. Every hardship is pushing me. It is asking the question, am I worthy of what I desire? Have I earned it? Not can I seize it? Not can I gain it? If I pull out all the stops and decide I'm going to be ruthless in my desire of acquisition, like the Romans, it is saying, am I worthy of it? Have I reached the standard that is deserving of that? And this mindset is completely different. This mindset keeps a man humble, keeps a man duty-bound. And duties has turned into a very dirty word in the modern age. But duty to one's family and folk is the utmost of survival. It is the basics of it. Anyway, I'll catch you for the last half hour after the break, guys. Feel free to ring in if you want to. I'll say the number after the break because obviously you're getting stuck with the voice. We'll catch you in a bit.
Sick of hearing all the same old commercials on Renegade Broadcasting?
Ugh, I have heard this damn Noel Ignatieff clip 6 million times. I get it already.
Well, we need your help to create new, exciting, and enlightening content for our breaks. Find yourself a decent microphone or borrow one from somebody else. Look up some royalty-free music or let us do it for you. Just get creative. Make the commercials 40 seconds long to fit our schedule. Winners will have their commercials played on the air and also receive some great prizes. For more details, please go to renegadebroadcasting.com/contest.
welcome back for the last half hour, guys. Girls, sorry. And if anybody wants to ring in, they can do. They're more than welcome for this last half hour. And the number is 747-999-6407. But I have got some material, so if nobody rings in, I should be good. But, yeah, so I was talking about these very different mindsets, these very different motivational forces. And when we start to understand them as motivational forces, we can start to understand and unwrap this mindset. And I talked about the power of striving, the power of seeking worth, not through domination, but through earning it. And this ties into duty, which I said at the very end of the last segment. It's become a very dirty word. It's become something that's seen, and so has laws. But laws of men, like the Cimbri, they abide laws. But these laws were not, they upheld their natural nobility. Their refusal to give in to Roman tactic, even to their own demise in the case of the Cimbri. But they held their value so highly that they were not going to lower themselves to the standards of their enemy because they knew that they would become it. And they could see no worse fate than losing their soul, which is what we're talking about. This is the mindset of the Europeans. This is why when I see Bronze Age pervert and Varg and all these alt-right tards telling me about this masculine domination, they do not know our ancestors. And maybe I have a slightly idealized view too. But like I said at the beginning, I look to their aspirations, to their dreams of me, their mythology, to what they wanted me to be, and try in my part to be that. To try in my part, and I fail in many ways. There are many improvements I need to make. When I talk about shame on my shows, I get worried because then I'm like, am I worthy? Am I worthy to tell others? When I still have I still don't do something, you know, I may have not tidied up my living room one evening because I was tired. I let things get the better of me. I let things slip away from me sometimes. And it seems like the more things slip away, you can't grasp them back. But those shows, I do them, I say it because that's what I believe that they felt. And I need to, by doing those shows, it forces me to live up to it more. It forces me to make myself better in every way. So rather than see what I can gain, get grabbed from this world, seize from it like some desperate scavenger. It's interesting that the whole paleo diet and all this paleo, they see us as scavengers in the Paleolithic time. This is the modern definition of us. Humans were scavengers. They want us to reduce us to that, just with fancy frills and gold linings. But it's the same, this desperate nature. We see it all around us. We see people scrimping and saving for mortgages, desperate, because they're uptight. And it was all said in that speech that they look and the butt of the jokes is the one that's got it the shittest. That's what I was saying earlier. Look at the poor whites. Look at those fucking idiots. Because it's denigration. It's based on denigration. It's based on degrading. It's based on valueless. Your value comes from what they haven't got. Your value comes from what you can take, not what you have earned by right of name and duty and adherence to the laws of nature, to the Mother Goddess. Like I say, I have no fear talking about my worship of the Divine Mother. I might get, you're a wussy, you're blah, blah, blah. I don't know. You know, I don't know what. You get all this kind of stuff. I get it with being a vegan, right? I have some compassion. Because of that compassion, they see me as weak. But that compassion is my greatest strength. The love is my greatest strength. This is all ruled by the mother. And this is why I serve her, and I have no fear of saying that. I have no fear of being in servitude to something that promotes life. I do not embrace these people. They serve money. They serve perversion. I know which one I want to serve. And about excelling in all areas. You know, if you look at the ancient past, you see the dreams of heroes. But what are these heroes? Do these heroes ever work for petty coin? Do these heroes of our mythology, these heroes ingrained in our minds, when I was a child, I'd watch them. I'd watch it on movies or read it in books. These great heroes, and they always fought for something better than them, something bigger than them. I said in a show before, I used to literally dream of dying in battle in some glorious act as a seven-year-old. When I saw those images or read those stories, I wanted to, at that moment, propel myself into some ancient battle. I have much to learn from that seven-year-old, because this world, like it does for all of us, grinds us down and starts to make us think like them. I've got to pay this, and I've got to do that, and I've got to do this. And if I screw over the next guy, I can make my rent. It makes us beggars. Makes beggars of us all. But that seven-year-old me did not fear the death of battle, saw it as a glory. And this is not to say that we should all go kill ourselves. But it is this noble idea of what we are. And that is the laws of our men. That is the duty of our folk. That is what we should be. You know, you can watch, look at movies like Lord of the Rings. And his speech, you know, Aragorn's speech, Last Men of the West. Are we at the time when the courage of men fails? I hope not. When the courage of men, because that was a lot of the inspiration for that. Although I'm no great fan of Tolkien because of his words against Adolf Hitler, but he did capture some of the essence and the spirit of the North. And this is why it's still popular to this day. He was also talking about the time of the mass industrialization of Europe, well, of Britain particularly, and how good men had to resist this devouring, because as we saw in that speech, it devours everything. Nothing can satisfy it. This will be their undoing, but we need to make sure it is their undoing before we are undone. That is the race that we are against. They would never rule this earth, this land. They would never rule the mother. She would shake them off. But in the process, do we fall too? She would do what she needs to protect herself. And we have to hope that we can do it for her. We can remove them before she has to remove all, because they will destroy themselves. That's all they know. If you want to take Lord of the Rings as an example, how they devour the forests to fuel their modern engines, their factory and their industry. Nothing is enough. The whole universe is not enough. I mean, how many times have you read a stupid article in some stupid paper talking about some comet made of diamonds? And it was everyone's salivating over the diamond, not the beauty of the comet, not the magnificence that something flies across our skies
took away, you know, whatever is up there, I don't even know anymore. I know NASA's full of shit, but instead of marveling at this glorious sight, we think of what it contains and what it can get, what monetary value we can draw from it. They've turned everything. They took, and they call us the romantic sentimentalists. Because we dream of something more. We dream of being heroes. We're just nothing but idiots, petty and stupid in their eyes, while they're so much civilized and so sophisticated with their big houses and their big mortgages that they cannot pay, living as slaves. And yet any dream of any nobility is belittled. This is what our world has done. It has belittled that, almost in some cases, childlike belief that our ancestors had. And I don't say that in a negative way. Why are we the most creative force on this planet? Because the Aryan has a childlike belief. He has that enthusiasm I was talking about earlier. And when he matches that enthusiasm with his determination, the world is whatever we want it to be. Because we can dream where others cannot. We can make real what's in our minds where others see only what is there. This childishness is not a negative thing. It is the imagination of our folk. It is seeing within the world the subtle nature of all things. My children often amaze me when I tell them stories, and they look and they're instantly drawn in to all that's around them. If I tell them of forest spirits and things, they see them immediately. Now, they will say, oh, you put it into their mind, they're just making it up. But they believe it. They feel it. They feel something. And they connect with it. I just give it a name is all. And once I give it a name, they can speak it to me. Before that, they cannot. You know, I was out with my children today. Went to the park. Because it was a beautiful sunny day. And they were playing in this park. So some very beautiful trees. And this goes back to the boundaries and spirit. Sometimes I just stand and I just, for all the hardships that we suffer, for all the obstacles that are in my way, and I'm having to sort all these things out. I'm in a park with trees with my children. And it's almost, sometimes you just look at the tree and your children playing around it. And you can almost just breathe in some kind of satisfaction, some kind of energy from the environment around you, as if you've connected to some spirit of the land that dwells there. And in that moment, all is good. But again, I'll be called a romantic sentimentalist, because I see past the mundane into something beyond it, some super mundane, some world beyond my vision. But I can feel it. I mean, and talking of hardship, I didn't really cover that in our ancestors' lives. And of course, they had hardship. That is why they worshipped the boar, because, like I say, it's a dual symbol. It is a symbol of the mother and hardship, because it's what the mother sends down when her children are not abiding by the rules. Our ancestors took that image, and rather than, this just to show you how they saw hardship, rather than take that image as a scornful one, which is what the Greeks started to do when they tried to reinterpret the mythology. They started to see the boar as struggle and pain. Our ancestors in the north held it aloft, like I said, as their banner. They became the boar, the struggle of life. And they made sure that anybody coming to conquer them knew that they were going to be the boar sent by the mother to deal with them. But when you breathe, like I say, in that field, and you can breathe it, I don't know if anybody does this. I mean, But it's almost like you can feel that spirit of all things pushing and pulling forces within you. But they're all, and all this clutter of the modern world, all these forms and all these whole things you have to do just dissipate. All the hardships become good. They drive you. You see purpose in them, even if just for a brief second. But the hardship our ancestors have to suffer was something we often see it as making them hardened to life. Hardened to life and death. And it's becoming something that I probably subscribed to not long ago. So the more they dealt with death, the less they paid attention to it. Or the less they revered life. The more they became scavengers. But I realize that this is part of that dominating, that Roman mind, that Eastern Semitic virus. It doesn't make you more ruthless. Just to point this out, many people think there's more people living today than there's ever been. Well, that's not true. They say, I think, 7 dead for every living. And you, except many people don't understand how this is, because it was obviously a lot less populated back then, because most people died as children. I think I talked about this a little bit with SC, but I want to bring it up here just because of the hardship aspect. So they had to deal with losing their children regularly through the harshness of nature, but they never scorned the mother. They never turned their back on nature. They still revered her and they understood her lessons. And they revered the dead more than we do today. We pay our petty remembrance and bury them and then move on. They revered them in everything they did. In that speech above, at the very end, it talks about honouring those before them. We built mounds and monuments to our dead that were the centre of our lands and on the boundaries of our lands. We built them everywhere. They dominated our lives. Like I say, in the centre of some Iron Age hill forts, you can find a Bronze Age burial 2,000 years before they existed. They still revere that ancestor. It did not make them feel less of life and make them see death as just something that they had to deal with. They revered it. They revered life and saw death, the death of a great man or the death of an innocent, as something that should be remembered. It made them more loving. It made every breath they took more precious. Every moment they spent with their children wasn't just a moment, an inconvenience which we see today. In the park, you see it. And I'm guilty of it. I'm trying to do something and they want my attention. But with this great loss, they understood the value of that moment. And they revered life. But like I say, slowly but surely, they stole this from us. Not just by their force, by their whip, but by infecting our minds and making us like them. And again, I say that I worship my ancestors. People laugh. They're like, what? I say, well, you could argue with me and debate me on the gods and the goddesses. But you cannot tell me my ancestors did not live. Because I know they did. I spoke to some of them. I touched them. I spent their company with them. My father, my mother. My grandparents. I was with them. I know they exist. Because they existed. They've just gone beyond my sight. But are they gone? Nothing disappears in this world. It just transforms. It doesn't matter what you do with it. Cut it down. I have compost heaps. In the compost heap, there's lots of things. In the end, it goes back to dirt. And then it gives life anew somewhere else. Nothing disappears. It just moves out of sight for a time. You know, the plants, they grow and they die. The seeds come back. So do we. So anybody that tells me that ancestor worship is pointless, I owe everything I have to them. How could anything like that be pointless? How could the reverence of the reverence of something so great that gave me life, allowed me to play the game of life, as they call it, but it's no game. It's not just existence, it's about the living. And when you know that all around you is alive, I mean, even inanimate objects our ancestors would give life to. Rocks, sculptures, carried within them some essence, some feeling, some spiritual aspect to it. The more I learn about my ancestors, the more I fall in love with who they were and what I should become. The way they saw the world was very different to how we do now, and it's very hard, even for me. I'm not claiming I can see it exactly as they do. I'm not so bold as to say that. I'm learning all the time. And with each thing I learn, sometimes I realize I was wrong. But I know within them there was a magic. And I know that it's still here today. It's why we still invent everything. It's why they use this against us. They use it for, like the speech said, for their ends. Like the speech said, they are fed by their masters, but it is Britain that feeds all the slaves. So it is not them. The slaves are feeding themselves. They're just being, there's just a middleman, and that's the master. Sucking off them like a parasite. And that, for anybody listening that thinks that they like these masculine domination ideas, that is its ultimate end. That is the idea of the Semitic mind. To make all things serve you. And to be too proud, too spiritually proud, to realize that it is you that has to serve. That you are duty bound, not to a master, but to the only possessions worthy of it, your kith and your kin. It's something that's a powerful idea. And like I said, when I get this new studio, when I get this new house, when we get into the new house, I'm going to get a studio. I'm going to really up my game with trying to get stuff out there. Because I was talking to somebody that offered some help with some videos recently, which I'm going to take up, and I'll be making some videos with their help. And we were talking just about how little there is on our ancestors. This is why these, and this is partly my fault. Why am I not producing? This is where your shame can drive you. This is where your power can drive you on. Why am I not producing then videos to counter these nonsense? Why am I not producing things, enough things on enough platforms and enough areas to make, I mean, YouTube, there's nothing on them, and you could easily get away with these types of videos because I'm just talking about our ancestors. Well, you'd hope you could get away with them. You know, who knows with how it's going. But you get all these ideas. And if that's if you can find anything at all, you look up stuff, you look up Iron Age documentaries, they're superficial at best. There's no spiritual aspect to them. Nobody talks about what they do. Look up well worship, you'll find very little. Water worship, not there. And this to me gives more importance to it, not just because I can see it's there, but that they don't want us to reconnect with actually who we are, to change our mindset from that of dominion, that of self-service, to one of duty, to worth and value. To ask the question, am I worthy of what I have? Not, can I seize it by any means? And I think this plays into our struggle today. We want to survive. We want our people to live on, but they must live on with the mindset of us, not the mindset of our enemies. Because then they devalue themselves. And they will forever be slaves and believe that they live under a civilization. But are we worthy? I believe we have within us the magic to be worthy. And I think that that is how we win this battle. Because this is not just one little battle. This is the war for our very survival. All the forces of nature that are on our side, all the ancestors at war with us know the crucial. Our ancestors may have had it harder, but they didn't have the absolute decimation of their people at hand wholesale. Not just their tribe, but all tribes. Not just their land, but all land. There has to be a force that's going to counter this, and it can only come from us. And the first step we need to do is make ourselves worthy. We need to be the immaculate, or at least try to be. We must be lights for others in everything we do. We must be the exemplary. We must never rest, never have enough toil. That is the only way we're going to get out of this mess. The only way we're going to show everybody else what we are. People follow when they see a good thing. We've got to become that good thing. And I believe the way to do that is by recapturing that mindset, the true mindset of our ancestors, not some bullshit pirate worship, bullshit perversions. We need to once again revere the mother and come back to our senses. Thanks for listening, guys. And thanks to all the supporters of Renegade. I know Carl's a very busy man, and here the support is very welcome.
You sit there in your
and all those other supporters of myself. Thanks, guys, and I'll catch you next week.
A crooked smile while you fed us lies. You didn't trust your own persuading. You sought to slay and to keep it by the few good men that warned. While the dawn is nigh, look to the sky, beware of an England scorned. Fall that I, the riddle I die.
Renegade Broadcasting has a sister site where you can find insightful articles from the past and present, the latest in health and wellness, research, analysis of current events, profound poetry, amazing artwork, lots of videos and podcasts from other content creators, and so much more. We are in a struggle to awaken as many people as possible, put an end to our enslavement in this toxic culture, and create a future where we can be happy, healthy, and free. Go to RenegadeTribune.com, browse the great content, and do consider joining the crew in publishing your own original work.
Letzter Blick, ein letzter Kuss. Und ich weiß, dass du jetzt gehen musst. Dein Geist ist müde, die Augen schwer. Ich fühle mich so hilflos, ich fühle mich so leer. Ich hör die Stimmen wild.